This is Civil Discourse on Gila Mimbres Community Radio and KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico. I'm your host, Jamie Newton. My guest is Tina Cordova, coordinator of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium, which she co-founded in 2005 with the late Fred Tyler. Tina, welcome and thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Jamie. It's great to join you again on your program. I'm glad for the opportunity.
This is a timely interview. We're recording it for broadcast on August 6, 2022. That's the anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan, and one day before the Gila Friends meeting, Quakers will hold their annual commemoration of the atomic bombings on Sunday, August 7th at 12:30 p.m. in Goff Park. That will be an opportunity for reflection and for rededication to a nuclear-free future for the world. The Friends welcome everyone in the community. After our listeners hear today's interview, I imagine they may feel a need for such an occasion. So, Tina Cordova, you've co-founded the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium in 2005, and you've coordinated the organization ever since. What was your purpose? Please tell us about the organization's mission and give us highlights of its activities during the 17 years of its history.
So Fred Tyler and I decided long ago, because our families had experienced so much loss, that we should form an organization to start bringing attention to the negative health effects suffered by the people of New Mexico as a result of their overexposure to radiation from the Trinity test. And initially, our whole goal was just to make sure that people understood that this had happened, that this had taken place, and that for generations, people had been made sick by their overexposure and that people were dying. When we started the organization, I was a cancer survivor. I had had thyroid cancer. And the first thing they asked me was, when were you exposed to radiation? And Fred had just lost his mother. And she had had three different types of cancer, I believe, before she passed away. He had had a career that had taken him away from New Mexico, and he had returned. And he realized that everybody in Tularosa, where we're from, were basically sick and dying. There were so many people sick and dying. And he tied it back to overexposure to radiation. And I had for years done that also. And so our mission has always been to bring attention to the negative health effects. And then we found out that there was a fund set up that had been taking care of what are called downwinders, the term used to describe those people who live downwind of a nuclear test site. We found out that there had been a fund set up and we had never been included. We were the first people ever to be exposed to radiation any place in the world. And there was this fund that we had been excluded from. And so part of our goal has always been to have New Mexico included in the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. So our goal is to educate people, allow people a safe place to gather with us to tell their stories and their histories, and then ultimately to be able to be included in RECA. We hold a couple of annual events. Well, actually, there's three events that we're dedicated to that we've been dedicated to for many years now. One is a candlelight vigil on the Saturday closest to July 16th, 1945, which was the date of the nuclear test at Trinity site, the beginning of the nuclear age. And so we hold a candlelight vigil where we memorialize the people that we've lost. And so people give us names of loved ones, and we put their name on Illuminatia, and we call their name out annually so that they're never forgotten. And then twice a year, we go to the Trinity site, the entrance off of the highway between San Antonio and Carrizozo, and then also the entrance in Tularosa. And we gather there in peaceful protest to the over-glorification of the science and industry, which is the only history that's ever been told about Trinity. We never hear about the people that lived as close as 12 miles to the test site. That's never been made part of the history. And so while we've heard the names of Groves and Oppenheimer and Fermi and Bradbury, et cetera, associated with this, we've never heard names like Gonzalez or Herrera or Cordova ever associated with what happened as a result of Trinity. So we hold those peaceful demonstrations to bring attention to the fact that we lived here, we're part of that history. The area wasn't remote and uninhabited, as is often told. And yes, we were harmed.
So, Tina Cordova, the Trinity test explosion was 77 years ago. It's clearly a very significant anniversary here. I've mentioned the 77th anniversary of the bombings in wartime of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but it was only a few weeks earlier, July 16th of 1945, that the Trinity test, the first atomic explosion, took place. And so any survivors who are still alive now would have been very young at the time. Are there any survivors still alive who were alive then as children? And how did that first atomic bomb in 1945, that test, affect people who lived nearby right away in the days and weeks and months after the test? And are there continuing impacts now, 77 years later, on the descendants of those people?
Well, the truth of the matter is, we say this all the time, we don't have a lot of elders left in our community. Those people would have been children at the time of the test, and they would have been so overexposed to radiation that it's no wonder they manifested disease later on in life and became ill and lost their lives. A good example is my own father, who was a four-year-old child, died from cancer that he developed in his throat and in his mouth. He wasn't a smoker, drank very seldom, didn't use chewing tobacco, had no viruses, but he developed two distinctly different oral cancers. And that just doesn't happen, except here in New Mexico. And I had, you know, I had explained to me before that it's very likely because my dad consumed a lot of cow's milk, fresh cow's milk, that they literally, were able to access on dairy farms. There were three active dairy farms in Tularosa when I was a kid. So at the time my dad was growing up, there were at least three of them. My grandmother would get milk from the local dairy. My dad drank gallons of milk, not glasses of milk. And it's likely that the radiation settled in the glands of his neck, giving off radiation for the remainder of his life, and then causing the horrible cancer that took his life. So we don't have elders, Jamie. It's very unfortunate. But we have had people that experienced the bomb, had cancer, survived to tell their histories. Henry Herrera comes to mind for me. He was an 11-year-old child in Tularosa on the day of the bomb. He witnessed the entire thing. He was outside with his father putting water in the radiator of his father's truck. It was 5:30 in the morning. His dad had to do this early because he would make the rounds and pick up other men from Tularosa to go to work. They worked out there. And he experienced the blast, and he also experienced the fallout that took place after the blast. Henry, until he died, and he passed away within the last 4 months, I would say, until that time, his recollection was so vivid and so profound because it was tied to some events that took place that day. First, the experience of putting water in the radiator and having the experience of the blast. But he said that he watched the fallout cloud go north of Tularosa, and then later in the day it came back over Tularosa. And the reason he remembered it so vividly is because his mother had hung out the laundry and everything got dusted with this black ash, and then she had to do it all over again. The reason that's significant is because we didn't have running water. In the small towns of New Mexico, we had no running water in 1945. We depended on the water that we collected into our cisterns for every source: drinking, cooking, bathing, cleaning. So his mother had to go through a really difficult process to rewash all that laundry. That's why Henry remembered it so well. We also have a lady, her name is Barbara Kent, who lives in California now, but lived in El Paso at the time and was at a dance camp in Rio Doso. She was 13. And she and the young ladies there in the dance camp experienced it. Henry had throat cancer, very similar to what my father had. And suffered for many, many years before he lost his life. Barbara developed cancer along with every one of the other girls in the dance camp, but they played in the ashes that fell from the sky. Barbara says they rubbed it all over their faces and on their bodies, and they stuck their tongues out and caught the ash on their tongues because in some bizarre way, she said, we thought it might be snowing in July and couldn't figure it out because it was warm outside. And she said, but this ash was also very warm. And all the other young ladies died before the age of 40. Barbara has lived, and I always say, only to tell your story because no one would believe it if I told it. But Barbara's story was recently profiled in National Geographic magazine. She's had three cancers. She's had multiple miscarriages, and her daughters have all had cancer. So that gives you sort of an overview of the types of things we've experienced. And I think to fully understand the history of this, not only do we have to understand that most people didn't have running water, we also didn't have electricity, so we had no refrigeration, which meant that every single thing we consumed was grown by us, raised by us, or hunted by us. Everybody had a garden and an orchard. Everybody had a milk cow or goat. We raised chickens, pigs, you know, sheep, cows for the purpose of protein, or we hunted. We, you know, everything we ate was now contaminated as the ash fell for days after the test. Also remember that in the days after the test at Trinity, the main part of the fallout plume was followed all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. And as it crossed the United States, it crossed Indiana, where Kodak had a film plant. And they used water from a local river to wash the cardboard that they would then package the film in. That cardboard was now contaminated, and it ruined all the film during that time frame that was processed out of that area. So it was strong enough, the fallout was strong enough still in the days afterwards, and as they followed the main part of the plume all the way to the Atlantic Ocean to damage film. You can imagine what happened to people who lived 12 miles away or 35 miles away or 45 miles away, like we did in Tularosa.
So, Tina Cordova, I have interviewed Elva Oesterreich, who wrote a book called The Manhattan Trinity Test, Witnessing the Bomb in New Mexico. She's collected stories of people who experienced the bomb. And I can recall only one where a child, a woman who was a child at the time, said that her father was advised to move some of his livestock out of the area. And so he knew something interesting would happen. And he got his family all on the banks of the Rio Grande to watch over in that direction. And so they saw the whole thing. That's the only story I can recall of someone who had a warning. Are you aware of government officials warning people in the area that they would be at risk of radiation and they should leave? Because clearly the radiation exposure was prolonged and it was intense.
So that's really the biggest mistake of the Manhattan Project. They knew, you know, people tell me all the time, well, they didn't know what they were doing, but that is absolutely false. They knew exactly what they were doing. First of all, they knew that radiation was dangerous to human health. That was already very well established. Secondly, in May of 1945, so 2 months in advance of the Trinity test, they conducted a test out at White Sands that most people don't know about. It was called the 100-ton test. It was also a nuclear test on a much smaller scale. They did that because they wanted to track the fallout and they wanted to see what was going to happen with the fallout. They knew that Trinity was going to produce massive fallout. They knew that that fallout would be laced with radiation and it would be dangerous to human health. General Groves was encouraged to prepare for evacuations. And so he finally relented and they lined up cattle trucks outside of Carrizozo. Because by all means, if you're going to evacuate human beings in New Mexico, you want to do it in a cattle truck. We had rail systems that ran through all of those towns, through Tularosa and Carrizozo and Socorro and on. And they could have lined up some rail cars, but they lined up a few cattle trucks. I have been told stories by many, many people. No one has ever told me about being warned ahead of time. I've read almost everything that's out there about the test. I've never read anywhere that anybody was warned. What I have heard as an example is that there was a gentleman in San Antonio that had a little grocery store and a place where people bought fuel. And he was told to take his family outside and in the morning of that day and that they would witness something that was going to be profound. But there was no warning given to anybody before or afterwards. And one of the things that really is hard for us to understand as victims is that after they did this, obviously, to maintain secrecy, but there was no attention given to our health, our well-being. Once the bombs were used in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, they absolutely could have come back. And then at that point, made sure that people understood what had taken place. To not ever inform us of the harm that had been inflicted is unconscionable. To allow people to continue to live their very organic lifestyles, completely dependent on their environment that now is just absolutely laced with radiation, is unconscionable. They knew those things. They knew that this had happened, and they simply walked away. And I always say, I think they counted on us to be uneducated, unsophisticated, and unable to stick up for ourselves. You know, there's a story that I've read about where they went to check on a ranching family afterwards that lived far too close to the test site. And you know, they showed up with Geiger counters, really rudimentary Geiger counters, by the way, which it's in the history, but well written, that those Geiger counters went off the scale in Carrizozo the day of the event. And they just told the men that were there monitoring, leave, you're not safe, leave. But they never told the people anything like that. So when they checked on this family, this ranching family, the man asked, what are you all doing? And they said, looking for radiation. And he said, you won't find any because we don't own a radio. And that's how little people knew. Right? I mean, it speaks to the unsophistication associated with how we lived our lives. People didn't have radios. They didn't have television. We didn't have telephones. We didn't have electricity. We had no way for communication to take place. So people were left just wondering what they had experienced. I mean, I have heard the most profound stories. It's truly remarkable what people experienced that day.
Mm. If you're just joining us here on Gila Mimbres Community Radio and KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, this is Civil Discourse. I'm your host, Jamie Newton, and my guest is Tina Cordova, co-founder and coordinator of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium. Tina, the consortium has circulated a map that shows levels of potential radiation exposure by distance from the Trinity site. And Silver City, New Mexico lies about midway between the 100 and 150 mile rings that show those distances from the Trinity site. What should Grant County people who see that map conclude about risks to people who were in this area at the time of the test?
Well, first, let me speak just briefly about the map. The map was intended to communicate how many people were living within each one of those radiuses, starting at 10-mile increments around the Trinity site, because throughout history, at the time of the test and throughout history, our government has always said that the area was remote and uninhabited, that no one lived here and no one was harmed. They still say that today at the open house. So we wanted to actually present a visual that people can look at and understand that is indeed not true. Lots of people lived here. At a 50-mile radius, there were about 15,000 children, women, and men living adjacent to the test site. At 150 miles, what you've just indicated, where Silver City lies, there were over 500,000 people living inside of that radius. That's far too many people. As an example, Jamie, RECA pays people that live in Winslow, Arizona, 259 miles from the Nevada test site. But it doesn't take care of anybody in New Mexico, not anybody that lives 12 miles, or like you said, where Silver City is at 120 miles. The reason that this is important to understand is because the Trinity test was one of a kind. It was the only time they ever tested a bomb on a platform 100 feet off the ground. The importance of that the bomb had no place to go. The power of the bomb had no place to go. It intercepted the earth. It took up an enormous amount of dirt, animal and plant life, incinerated it because it produced more heat than the sun, more light than the sun. And it took this fireball up that passed the atmosphere and penetrated the stratosphere. As you know, everything that goes up like that has to come down. And so an ash rained down for days afterwards. And that ash has been dispersed all over our state, certainly within inside of that 100 to 150 mile radius. And that's what we want to depict with that map. So what should the people in the Silver City area be concerned with? They should be concerned with the fact that the plutonium in the bomb, it was very inefficient. They used 13 pounds of plutonium when they only needed 3 pounds for the fission process. A full 10 pounds of plutonium went up in that fireball. Plutonium is the most poisonous substance known to man. You only have to inhale, ingest, or absorb one particle, and it remains there throughout time, irradiating the cells in your body. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years or 7,000 generations. It's never going to go away. It is going to be part of the environment in New Mexico forever. During the Manhattan Project, a lot of people don't know this either. I just recently became aware of this within the last couple of years. They were actually seizing people's organs at autopsy to check for plutonium. And this is the only place that they ever found plutonium in people's organs. The other thing too, Jamie, is that there are other radioactive isotopes that are released during a bomb like that. There's iodine, which has a shorter half-life and causes thyroid cancer. And we have a very high level of thyroid cancer in New Mexico. A lot of women have thyroid disease, which is oftentimes a precursor to thyroid cancer. So there was the radioactive iodine. The iodine pathway is one of most concern because the cows also take up the iodine concentrated in their mammary glands, and then it's dispersed in their milk. So there's that was happening to people throughout New Mexico. Then there's radioactive strontium and cesium. Strontium happens to be the one that you take up in your bones. It has a half-life of about 32 years. So for at least 32 years after Trinity, if people absorbed the strontium, it was still in their bodies, irradiating their cells and their tissues and their organs. These are all things that are highly concerning. And the history is the reason we don't have above ground testing anymore is because of a project. It was called the Tooth Fairy Project, where they were asking people to turn in their children's teeth as they shed them, their baby teeth. And they started testing them for strontium. And there's teeth in this collection, actually, from the state of New Mexico. And there's a group of people right now through Harvard University that start evaluating these teeth again. But at the time in the 60s when they did this work, they absolutely found strontium in children's teeth. And that's when President Kennedy, along with Khrushchev, decided this is immoral. Our children now have the marker for the nuclear testing that were done in their teeth, and we can no longer do this. And that's what led to the test ban treaty that President Kennedy signed in 1963, and the reason we don't have above ground testing any longer. So I'm certain when they reinvigorate this program and start looking at children, especially those from New Mexico, they're going to find that we have strontium in our teeth as a result of our exposure through Trinity and also our exposure through the Nevada test site.
That's such a remarkable history. Let's turn our attention now to RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which was set to expire on July 10th, a few weeks ago. And on June 7th, just a few weeks before RECA would have expired, President Joe Biden signed into law a 2-year extension, which does not seem terribly long for that. So there probably is additional work to be done on that. Now, advocacy for coverage under RECA for New Mexico's downwinders and others has always been a major focus of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium. So Tina Cordova, please explain to our listeners the status now of downwinders with respect to RECA coverage. Who is covered? Who is not covered? What is the official justification for excluding those who are not covered? And what are the prospects now for including people who aren't covered, although they have been exposed to radiation from weapons testing and from handling of nuclear materials?
The RECA program was established in 1990. It was a bipartisan program. The origins of it are pretty interesting, actually, and I'll try to cover that part quickly. Stuart Udall, who was Secretary of the Interior, had had a career in D.C., and when he retired, he returned to Utah, where he was from. Stuart Udall was our Senator Udall's father, and our Senator Udall told me this story directly. When his father returned to Utah and realized there were all these people sick and dying, he filed lawsuits on behalf of them and on behalf of uranium miners, because we have this huge uranium mining industry that existed at one point in New Mexico. And I'll touch on that in just a minute. But let me focus on the origins of RECA. So Secretary Udall started filing lawsuits, and they were winning in the courts. But at each level, the courts were saying it was in the interest of national security, so we're not going to hold the U.S. government accountable for the harm that was done to people. He made it all the way to the 10th Circuit of Appeals, and he knew that at the Supreme Court, he would find the same result. So he went to D.C. and he met with members of Congress, two senators in particular, Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, Senator Ted Kennedy of Maine, and he said, we need to pass a bill to take care of these people. What we've done to them is absolutely not acceptable. Stuart Udall really believed that the government had decided to move forward with this program, even if it meant that American citizens would die, and American citizens did die. So they instituted the RECA program 32 years ago, and they only called out certain counties in Utah, Nevada, and Arizona as compensable. There's never been a good answer given for why other counties in those states were left out, or as an example, why New Mexico was not included. We were the first people ever exposed to radiation. You know, I've asked many, many times, and the best answer I've ever been given is no one was looking out for you. And I always say, really? Well, we had two U.S. senators just like the other states that were included. So we're fighting now to bring justice to the people of New Mexico. And what the new bill will do is it will add the other states that we know experienced significant fallout from Nevada, states like Idaho and Montana, Colorado. So what the new bill will do is add New Mexico for the first time, Idaho, Montana, Colorado. It will add all of Arizona, all of Nevada, and all of Utah instead of just select counties. It will also add what are called the post-71 uranium workers, because after 1971, uranium became commercially available for power plants. And at that point, the U.S. government said, we're not taking responsibility anymore because industry should share in making people whole after they've been damaged. And you and I both know that it's really tough to work with industry in cases like that. So we have in New Mexico a great number of post-71 uranium workers. Through Navajo Nation, Laguna, and Acoma Pueblo, we have over 1,000 abandoned milling and mining sites. We had over 500 mine sites spread across the Navajo Nation, Laguna, and Acoma Pueblo. They extracted 32 million tons of uranium. They exploited the land and the people to do that. And so we have a lot of uranium workers that are not covered by RECA now. So what would RECA do? It would allow people to apply for a one-time payment of restitution, what's called compassionate payment of restitution, of $150,000, up from $50,000. People would be able to apply on behalf of their deceased loved ones if they meet all the criteria, and they can present proof of meeting the criteria. Current people who are currently living with or suffering with cancer and meet the criteria would also be able to apply for healthcare coverage, the very best that's available any place in the world, Jamie. Nuclear workers are already included in that program, and they are very well taken care of if they're made sick as a result of working in the nuclear industry. We're asking for the same sort of attention. The other thing that would happen through RECA that is very, very important is it would establish some clinics throughout the state of New Mexico where people could go for free to be screened for cancer. That would also be very important. So we're right now, we have enough votes in the House of Representatives right now in a bipartisan effort. We have enough votes there. But in the Senate, we have to reach cloture. We have to have 60 votes in the Senate. We're at about 54. We believe we'll get all 50 Democrats and 4 Republicans. But we need 6 more Republicans. And we're working very hard on key Republican members of the Senate from states like Montana. So we're working on Senator Daines. We're working on both Senator Lee and Romney from Utah. We're also working on Senators Cornyn and Cruz from Texas, because Texas was the second leading producer of uranium. They host 71 uranium workers. So for the essentially the 5 senators that I've named, they all have affected constituents. This should be a no-brainer. So we have work to do, but we work on this every day. We work on this every day. And I work with a national coalition. I have brothers and sisters that I work with from Guam, because it would include Guam for the first time. And I'm working with people from Utah and Idaho and Montana and Arizona and you name it. And we're working very hard and we're getting closer every day.
I'm glad we can end on that hopeful note. You've been listening to Civil Discourse on Gila Mimbres Community Radio, broadcasting as KURU on 89.1 FM in Silver City, New Mexico, and streaming on the World Wide Web at gncr.org. My guest has been Tina Cordova, co-founder and coordinator of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium. Tina, thank you so much for speaking to our listeners.
Thank you, Jamie. And if anybody wants more information about our work, they can go to our website. It's www.trinitydownwinders.com. I appreciate your time, Jamie.
Thank you, Tina. And thanks to all of you for listening and for supporting Gila Mimbres Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Jamie Newt.